I've made enough money to look after my family for 7 generations. I don't need to be here, he screamed in Tony's face. Tony roared back in his Irish brogue. I don't have a cent, and I don't need to be here either. Elizabeth had to step in to defuse the situation. Dave Nelson thought that Tony would be fired, and that he'd have a new boss by Monday morning. Yet Tony somehow survived the confrontation. Chelsea tried to complain to Elizabeth about Sonny, but she couldn't get through to her. Their bond seemed too strong to be shaken. Whenever Elizabeth came out of her office, which was separated from Sonny's by a glass conference room, he would immediately pop out of his and walk with her. Often, he accompanied her all the way to the bathrooms in the back of the building, prompting some employees to wonder half-jokingly if they were snorting lines of cocaine back there. By February 2010, after 6 months on the job, Chelsea had lost all her enthusiasm for working at Theranos and was thinking of quitting. She hated Sonny. The Mexico and Thailand projects seemed to be losing steam as the swine flu pandemic subsided. The company was lurching from one ill-conceived initiative to another, like a child with attention deficit disorder. On top of it all, Chelsea's boyfriend lived in Los Angeles, and she was flying back and forth between LA and the Bay Area every weekend to see him. The commute was killing her. As she debated what to do, something happened that hastened her decision. One day, the Stanford student whose family connections Elizabeth had tapped in Mexico came by with his father. Chelsea wasn't there to witness the visit, but the office was buzzing about it afterward. The father was going through some sort of cancer scare. Upon hearing of his health worries, Elizabeth and Sonny had convinced him to let Theranos test his blood for cancer biomarkers. Tony Nugent, who wasn't there for the encounter either, heard about it later that day from Gary Frenzel. Well, that was interesting, Gary told Tony, his voice conveying bewilderment. We played doctor today. Chelsea was appalled. The validation study in Belgium and the experiments in Mexico and Thailand were one thing. Those were supposed to be for research purposes only, and to have no bearing on the way patients were treated. But encouraging someone to rely on a Theranos blood test to make an important medical decision was something else altogether. Chelsea found it reckless and irresponsible. She became further alarmed when not long afterward, Sonny and Elizabeth began circulating copies of the requisition forms doctors use to order blood tests from laboratories and speaking excitedly about the great opportunities that lay in consumer testing. I'm done, Chelsea thought to herself. This has crossed too many lines. She approached Elizabeth and told her she wanted to resign, but decided to keep her qualms to herself. Instead, she told her friend that her weekend commutes were taking too great a toll and that she wanted to move to Los Angeles full-time, which in any case was true. She offered to stay on for a transition period, but Elizabeth and Sonny didn't want her to. If Chelsea was leaving, better she do so right away, they told her. They asked her not to say anything to the 3 employees who reported to her on her way out. Chelsea protested. It didn't feel right to flee like a thief in the middle of the night. But Sonny and Elizabeth were firm. She was not to speak to them. Chelsea walked out of the building and into the Palo Alto sunshine with conflicting emotions. The dominant one was relief. But she also felt bad that she hadn't been able to say goodbye to her team and to tell them why she was leaving. She would have given them the official reason that she was moving to LA, but Sonny and Elizabeth hadn't trusted her to do that. They'd wanted to control the narrative of her departure. Chelsea also worried about Elizabeth. In her relentless drive to be a successful startup founder, she had built a bubble around herself that was cutting her off from reality. And the only person she was letting inside was a terrible influence. How could her friend not see that? Chapter 7. Dr. J. As the calendar turned from 2009 to 2010, America remained mired in a deep economic malaise. Over the previous 2 years, nearly 9 million people had lost their jobs in the worst downturn since the Great Depression. Millions more had been hit with foreclosure notices. But in the 1,500-square-mile area south of San Francisco that forms the boundaries of Silicon Valley, animal spirits were stirring again. A new luxury hotel on Sand Hill Road, called the Rosewood, was always full, despite room rates that reached $1,000 a night. With its imported palm trees and proximity to the Stanford campus, it had quickly become the destination of choice for venture capitalists, startup founders, and out-of-town investors who flocked to its restaurant and poolside bar to discuss deals and be seen. Bentleys, Maseratis, and McLarens lined its stone parking lot. While the rest of the country licked its wounds from the devastating financial crisis, a new technology boom was getting underway, fueled by several factors. One of them was the wild success of Facebook. In June 2010, the social network's private valuation rose to $23 billion. 6 months later, it jumped to $50 billion. Every startup founder in the Valley wanted to be the next Mark Zuckerberg, and every VC wanted a seat on the next rocket ship to riches. The emergence of Twitter, which was valued at more than $1 billion in late 2009, added to the excitement. Meanwhile, the iPhone and competing smartphones featuring Google's Android operating system were beginning to usher in a shift to mobile computing, as cellular networks became faster and capable of handling larger amounts of data. Wildly popular mobile games like Angry Birds, which millions of iPhone users were paying a dollar each to download, seeded the notion that you could build a business around a smartphone app. In the spring of 2010, an obscure startup called Uber Cab did a beta launch of its black car hailing service in San Francisco. All of this might not have been enough to ignite the new boom, however, if it hadn't been for another key ingredient: rock-bottom interest rates. To rescue the economy, the Federal Reserve had slashed rates to close to zero, making traditional investments like bonds unattractive and sending investors searching for higher returns elsewhere. One of the places they turned to was Silicon Valley. Suddenly, the managers of East Coast hedge funds that normally invested only in publicly traded stocks were making the pilgrimage west in search of promising new opportunities in the private startup world. They were joined by executives from old established companies looking to harness the Valley's innovation to rejuvenate businesses battered by the recession. Among this latter group was a 65-year-old man from Philadelphia who greeted people with high fives in lieu of handshakes and went by the sobriquet Dr. J. Dr. J's real name was Jay Rosen, and he was, in fact, a doctor, though he had spent most of his career working for big corporations. He was a member of Walgreens innovation team, which was tasked with identifying new ideas and technologies that could reboot growth at the 109-year-old drugstore chain. Dr. J operated out of an office in the Philadelphia suburb of Conshohocken that Walgreens had inherited from its 2007 acquisition of Take Care Health Systems, an operator of in-store clinics where he'd previously been employed. In January 2010, Theranos had approached Walgreens with an email stating that it had developed small devices capable of running any blood test from a few drops pricked from a finger in real time and for less than half the cost of traditional laboratories. 2 months later, Elizabeth and Sonny traveled to Walgreens headquarters in the Chicago suburb of Deerfield, Illinois, and gave a presentation to a group of Walgreens executives. Dr. J, who flew up from Pennsylvania for the meeting, instantly recognized the potential of the Theranos technology. Bringing the startup's machines inside Walgreens stores could open up a big new revenue stream for the retailer and be the game changer it had been looking for, he believed. It wasn't just the business proposition that appealed to Dr. J. A health nut who carefully watched his diet, rarely drank alcohol, and was fanatical about getting a swim in every day, he was passionate about empowering people to live healthier lives. The picture Elizabeth presented at the meeting of making blood tests less painful and more widely available so they could become an early warning system against disease deeply resonated with him. That evening, he could barely contain his excitement over dinner at a wine bar with two Walgreens colleagues who weren't privy to the secret discussions with Theranos. After asking them to keep what he was about to tell them confidential, he revealed in a hushed tone that he'd found a company he was convinced would change the face of the pharmacy industry. "Imagine detecting breast cancer before the mammogram," he told his enraptured colleagues, pausing for effect. A few minutes before 8 a.m. on August 24, 2010, a group of rental cars pulled up in front of 3200 Hillview Avenue in Palo Alto. A stocky man with glasses and dimples on his wide nose stepped out of one of them. His name was Kevin Hunter, and he headed a small lab consulting firm called Collaborate. He was part of a Walgreens delegation led by Dr. J that had flown to California for a two-day meeting with Theranos. The drugstore chain had hired him a few weeks before to help evaluate and set up a partnership it was negotiating with the startup. Hunter had a special affinity for the business Walgreens was in. His father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had all been pharmacists. Growing up, he'd spent the summers helping his dad man the counter and stock the shelves of the pharmacies he ran on air bases in New York, Texas, and New Mexico. As familiar as he was with drugstores, though, Hunter's real expertise was with clinical laboratories. After getting his MBA at the University of Florida, he had spent the first 8 years of his career working for Quest Diagnostics, the giant provider of lab services. He had subsequently launched Collaborate, which advised clients ranging from hospitals to private equity firms about laboratory issues. The first thing Hunter noticed as he shut the door of his rental car and walked toward the entrance of Theranos' office was a shiny black Lamborghini parked right next to it. "Looks like someone is trying to impress us," he thought. Elizabeth and Sonny greeted him and the rest of the Walgreens team at the top of a flight of stairs and showed them to the glass conference room between their offices. They were joined there by Daniel Young, who had succeeded Seth Michelson as head of Theranos' biomath team. On the Walgreens side, in addition to Hunter and Dr. J, three others had made the trip: a Belgian executive named Renat Vandenhoef, a financial executive named Dan Doyle, and Jim Sundberg, who worked with Hunter at Collaborate. Dr. J high-fived Sonny and Elizabeth, then sat down and kicked off the meeting with the same line he always used when he introduced himself. "Hi, I'm Dr. J, and I used to play basketball." Hunter had already heard him use it a dozen times in the few weeks they'd worked together and no longer thought it was funny, but for Dr. J it was a joke that never seemed to grow old. It elicited a few awkward chuckles. "I'm so excited that we're doing this," Dr. J then exclaimed. He was referring to a pilot project the companies had agreed to. It would involve placing Theranos' readers in 30 to 90 Walgreens stores no later than the middle of 2011. The store's customers would be able to get their blood tested with just a prick of the finger and receive their results in under an hour. A preliminary contract had already been signed, under which Walgreens had committed to pre-purchase up to $50 million worth of Theranos cartridges and to loan the startup an additional $25 million. If all went well with the pilot, the companies would aim to expand their partnership nationwide. It was unusual for Walgreens to move this quickly. Opportunities the innovation team identified usually got waylaid in internal committees and slowed down by the retailer's giant bureaucracy. Dr. J had managed to fast-track this one by going straight to Wade Miquelon, Walgreens' chief financial officer, and getting him behind the project. Miquelon was due to fly in that evening and join them at the next day's session. About half an hour into discussions centering on the pilot, Hunter asked where the bathroom was. Elizabeth and Sonny visibly stiffened. Security was paramount, they said, and anyone who left the conference room would have to be escorted. Sonny accompanied Hunter to the bathroom, waited for him outside the bathroom door, and then walked him back to the conference room. It seemed to Hunter unnecessary and strangely paranoid. On his way back from the bathroom, he scanned the office for a laboratory but didn't see anything that looked like one. That's because it was downstairs, he was told. Hunter said he hoped to see it at some point during the visit, to which Elizabeth responded, "Yes, if we have time." Theranos had told Walgreens it had a commercially ready laboratory and had provided it with a list of 192 different blood tests it said its proprietary devices could handle. In reality, although there was a lab downstairs, it was just an R&D lab where Gary Frenzel and his team of biochemists conducted their research. Moreover, half of the tests on the list couldn't be performed as chemiluminescent immunoassays, the testing technique the Edison system relied on. They required different testing methods beyond the Edison scope. The meeting resumed and stretched into the middle of the afternoon, at which point Elizabeth suggested they grab an early dinner in town. As they got up from their chairs, Hunter asked again to see the lab. Elizabeth tapped Dr. J on the shoulder and motioned for him to follow her outside the conference room. He returned moments later and told Hunter it wasn't going to happen. Elizabeth wasn't willing to show them the lab yet, he said. Instead, Sonny showed the Walgreens team his office. There was a sleeping bag on the floor behind his desk. His bathroom had a shower in it, and he kept a change of clothes on hand. He worked such long hours that on many nights he crashed at the office, he proudly told the visitors. As they headed out to eat, Sonny and Elizabeth made them leave at staggered intervals. They didn't want everyone to arrive at the restaurant at the same time on the grounds that it risked attracting notice. They also instructed Hunter and his colleagues not to use names. When Hunter got to the restaurant, a little sushi place on El Camino Real called Fuki Sushi, the hostess took him to a private room in the back with sliding doors, where Elizabeth was waiting. The cloak and dagger theatrics struck Hunter as silly. It was 4 p.m, and the restaurant was empty. There was no one to conceal their presence from. What's more, if there was anything likely to draw attention, it was Sonny's Lamborghini in the parking lot. Hunter was beginning to grow suspicious. With her black turtleneck, her deep voice, and the green kale shakes she sipped on all day, Elizabeth was going to great lengths to emulate Steve Jobs, but she didn't seem to have a solid understanding of what distinguished different types of blood tests. Theranos had also failed to deliver on his two basic requests, to let him see its lab and to demonstrate a live vitamin D test on its device. Hunter's plan had been to have Theranos test his and Dr. J's blood, then get retested at Stanford Hospital that evening and compare the results. He'd even arranged for a pathologist to be on standby at the hospital to write the order and draw their blood. But Elizabeth claimed she'd been given too little notice, even though he'd made the request 2 weeks ago. There was something else that bothered Hunter, Sonny's attitude. He acted both superior and cavalier. When the Walgreens side had broached bringing its IT department in on the pilot preparations, Sonny had dismissed the idea out of hand by saying, "IT are like lawyers. Avoid them as long as possible." That kind of approach sounded to Hunter like a recipe for problems. Dr. J didn't seem to share his skepticism, though. He appeared taken with Elizabeth's aura and to revel in the Silicon Valley scene. He reminded Hunter of a groupie who'd flown across the country to attend a concert played by his favorite band. When they reconvened at the Theranos office the next morning, they were joined by Wade Miquelon, the Walgreens CFO. Wade had negotiated the pilot contract directly with Elizabeth. He, too, seemed to be a big fan of hers. Midway through that day's meeting, Elizabeth made a big show of giving Miquelon an American flag that she said had been flown over a battlefield in Afghanistan. She'd written a dedication to Walgreens on it. Hunter thought the whole thing was bizarre. Walgreens had brought him here to vet Theranos' technology, but he hadn't been allowed to do so. The only thing they had to show for their visit was an autographed flag. And yet, Dr. J and Miquelon didn't seem to mind. As far as they were concerned, the visit had gone swimmingly. A month later, in September 2010, a group of Walgreens executives met with Elizabeth and Sonny in a conference room at the drugstore chain's Deerfield headquarters. The mood was festive. Red balloons with the Walgreens logo floated above a table laden with hors d'oeuvres. Wade Miquelon and Dr. J were unveiling Project Beta, the code name for the Theranos pilot, to senior Walgreens executives. Standing in front of a slide titled Disrupting the Lab Industry, projected on a big screen, one of the Walgreens executives was singing along to Imagine. To celebrate the alliance, the innovation team had come up with the idea of adapting the lyrics to the John Lennon song and using it as the partnership's anthem. When the awkward karaoke act was over, Elizabeth and Sonny encouraged the Walgreens executives to get their blood tested. They had brought along several black and white machines to the meeting. The Walgreens executives lined up to get their fingers pricked behind Kermit Crawford, the president of the pharmacy business, and Colin Watts, the head of the innovation team. Hunter, who was now working for Walgreens full-time as an on-site consultant for the innovation team, didn't take part in the meeting. But when he heard that several Walgreens executives had had their blood tested, he figured this was an opportunity to finally see how the technology performed. He told himself to follow up with Elizabeth about the test results next time they talked. In a report he'd put together after the Palo Alto visit, Hunter had warned that Theranos might be overselling or overstating where they are at scientifically with the cartridge's devices. He'd also recommended that Walgreens embed someone at Theranos through the pilot's launch and had volunteered one of his collaborate colleagues, a petite British woman by the name of June Smart, who'd recently completed a stint administering Stanford's labs for the assignment. Theranos had rejected the idea. Hunter asked about the blood test results a few days later on the weekly video conference call the companies were using as their primary mode of communication. Elizabeth responded that Theranos could only release the results to a doctor. Dr. J, who was dialed in from Conshohocken, reminded everyone that he was a trained physician, so why didn't Theranos go ahead and send him the results? They agreed that Sonny would follow up separately with him. A month passed, and still no results. Hunter's patience was wearing thin. During that week's call, the two sides discussed a sudden change Theranos had made to its regulatory strategy. It had initially represented that its blood tests would qualify as waived under the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments, the 1988 federal law that governed laboratories. CLIA waived tests usually involved simple laboratory procedures that the Food and Drug Administration had cleared for home use. Now, Theranos was changing its tune and saying the tests it would be offering in Walgreens stores were laboratory-developed tests. It was a big difference. Laboratory-developed tests lay in a gray zone between the FDA and another federal health regulator, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. CMS, as the latter agency was known, exercised oversight of clinical laboratories under CLIA, while the FDA regulated the diagnostic equipment that laboratories bought and used for their testing. But no one closely regulated tests that labs fashioned with their own methods. Elizabeth and Sonny had a testy exchange with Hunter over the significance of the change. They maintained that all the big laboratory companies mostly used laboratory-developed tests, which Hunter knew not to be true. To Hunter, The switch made it all the more important to check the accuracy of Theranos' tests. He suggested doing a 50-patient study in which they would compare Theranos results to ones from Stanford Hospital. He'd done work with Stanford and knew people there. It would be easy to arrange. On the computer screen, Hunter noticed an immediate change in Elizabeth's body language. She became visibly guarded and defensive. "No, I don't think we want to do that at this time," she said, quickly changing the subject to other items on the call's agenda. After they hung up, Hunter took aside Renat Vandenhoof, who was in charge of the pilot on the Walgreens side, and told him something just wasn't right. The red flags were piling up. First, Elizabeth had denied him access to their lab. Then she'd rejected his proposal to embed someone with them in Palo Alto. And now she was refusing to do a simple comparison study. To top it all off, Theranos had drawn the blood of the president of Walgreens' pharmacy business, one of the company's most senior executives, and failed to give him a test result. Vandenhoof listened with a pained look on his face. "We can't not pursue this," he said. "We can't risk a scenario where CVS has a deal with them in 6 months and it ends up being real." Walgreens' rivalry with CVS, which was based in Rhode Island and one-third bigger in terms of revenues, colored virtually everything the drugstore chain did. It was a myopic view of the world that was hard to understand for an outsider like Hunter, who wasn't a Walgreens company man. Theranos had cleverly played on this insecurity. As a result, Walgreens suffered from a severe case of FOMO, the fear of missing out. Hunter pleaded with Vandenhoof to at least let him peek inside the one black-and-white reader Theranos had left with them after the Project Beta kickoff party. He was dying to tear the strips of security tape off its case and crack it open. Theranos had sent them some test kits for it, but they were for obscure blood tests like a flu susceptibility panel that no other lab he knew of offered. It was therefore impossible to compare their results to anything. How convenient, Hunter had noted. Moreover, the kits were expired. Vandenhoof said no. In addition to signing confidentiality agreements, they'd been sternly warned not to tamper with the reader. The contract the companies had signed stated that Walgreens agreed not to disassemble or otherwise reverse engineer the devices or any component thereof. Trying to contain his frustration, Hunter made one last request. Theranos always invoked two things as proof that its technology had been vetted. The first was the clinical trial work it did for pharmaceutical companies. Documents it gave Walgreens stated that the Theranos system had been comprehensively validated over the last 7 years by 10 of the largest 15 pharma companies. The second was a review of its technology Dr. J had supposedly commissioned from Johns Hopkins University's medical school. Hunter had placed calls to pharmaceutical companies and hadn't been able to get anyone on the phone to confirm what Theranos was claiming, though that was hardly proof of anything. He now asked Vandenhoof to show him the Johns Hopkins review. After some hesitation, Vandenhoof reluctantly handed him a 2-page document. When Hunter was done reading it, he almost laughed. It was a letter dated April 27, 2010, summarizing a meeting Elizabeth and Sonny had had with Dr. J and 5 university representatives on the Hopkins campus in Baltimore. It stated that they had shown the Hopkins team proprietary data on test performance and that Hopkins had deemed the technology novel and sound. But it also made clear that the university had conducted no independent verification of its own. In fact, the letter included a disclaimer at the bottom of the second page. The materials provided in no way signify an endorsement by Johns Hopkins Medicine to any product or service. Hunter told Vandenhoof the letter was meaningless. Judging from the Belgian's expression, he sensed that he was starting to make headway. Vandenhoof's confidence seemed shaken. Hunter knew that Dan Doyle, The executive responsible for the innovation team's finances shared some of his skepticism. If he could convert Vandenhoff to their point of view, they might get Dr. J and Wade Miquelon to see the light and avert a potential disaster. Walgreens wasn't the only big retail partner Theranos was courting. During this same period, Theranos employees began noticing visits to the Hillview Avenue office from an older gentleman with an earnest air who wore rimless glasses and a suit and tie. It was Steve Bird, the CEO of Safeway. Bird had been at the helm of Safeway, one of the country's biggest supermarket chains, for 17 years. Along the way, his disciplined focus on the X's and O's of the grocery business, which had earned him plaudits from Wall Street during his first decade as CEO, had given way to an intense interest in healthcare. He'd gotten hooked on the subject after realizing that Safeway's rising medical costs threatened to someday bankrupt the company if he didn't do something to tame them. He'd pioneered innovative wellness and preventive health programs for his employees and become an advocate for universal health coverage, making him one of the only Republican CEOs to embrace many of the tenets of Obamacare. Like Dr. J, he was serious about his own health. He worked out on a treadmill at 5 every morning and lifted weights in the evenings after dinner. At Bird's invitation, Elizabeth came to the supermarket chain's headquarters in Pleasanton, on the other side of San Francisco Bay, to make a presentation. As the Safeway CEO and a group of his top executives listened, intrigued, she described how her phobia of needles had led her to develop breakthrough technology that made blood tests not only more convenient, but faster and cheaper. She brought along one of her black and white devices to demonstrate how it worked. The presentation had a strong impact on Larry Renda, Safeway's executive vice president. Renda's husband was battling lung cancer. His blood had to be tested frequently so that doctors could adjust his drug regimen. Each blood draw was an exercise in torture because his veins were collapsing. Theranos' finger prick system would be a godsend for him, she thought. Renda, who had started out at Safeway at age 16 as a part-time bagger and worked her way up the corporate ladder to become one of Bird's most trusted executives, could see that her boss was also very impressed. The Theranos proposition dovetailed perfectly with his wellness philosophy and offered a way to improve the supermarket chain's stagnating revenues and razor-thin profit margins. Before long, Safeway, too, signed a deal with Theranos. Under the agreement, it loaned the startup $30 million and pledged to undertake a massive renovation of its stores to make room for sleek new clinics where customers would have their blood tested on the Theranos devices. Bird was over the moon about the partnership. He saw Elizabeth as a precocious genius and treated her with rare deference. Normally loath to leave his office unless it was absolutely necessary, he made an exception for her, regularly driving across the bay to Palo Alto. On one occasion, he arrived bearing a huge white orchid. On another, he brought her a model of a private jet. Her next one, he predicted, would be real. Bird was aware of Theranos's parallel discussions with Walgreens. Elizabeth told him his company would be the exclusive purveyor of Theranos blood tests in supermarkets, while Walgreens would be granted exclusivity in drugstores. Neither company was thrilled with the arrangement, but both saw it as better than missing out on a huge new business opportunity. Back in Chicago, Hunter's efforts to get Vandenhoff to take his suspicions seriously were dashed in mid-December 2010, when Vandenhoff informed his colleagues that he would be leaving at the end of the year. He'd been offered a job as the CEO of a company in New Jersey that made temperature indicators for pharmaceutical companies. It was a career opportunity he couldn't pass up. Walgreens appointed an internal replacement, a female executive named Trish Lipinski, who had some exposure to the laboratory world. Before coming to Walgreens, she had worked at the College of American Pathologists, the medical association representing laboratory scientists. Hunter wasted no time letting her know how he felt about the Theranos project. "I've got to stop this, because someday this is going to be a black eye on someone," he told her. He also voiced his skepticism directly to Dr. J, but that was of little use. Dr. J was a staunch and tireless advocate for Theranos. If anything, he thought Walgreens was moving too slowly. After learning of the model jet Steve Bird had given Elizabeth, he'd railed to Trish that Walgreens needed to show her more love. To Hunter's amazement, he had even stopped asking Elizabeth and Sonny about the test results from the kickoff party. He was apparently willing to let Theranos get away with not producing them. Dr. J had a powerful ally in Wade Miquelon. A sharp dresser with a taste for expensive suits and designer eyeglasses, Wade was gregarious and well-liked at Walgreens. However, many of his colleagues had begun to question his judgment after a story in the Chicago Tribune revealed that he'd been arrested for driving drunk that fall for the second time in a little over a year. He shouldn't have been behind the wheel of a car at all. His driver's license was still suspended from the previous arrest. To make matters worse, he'd refused to take a breathalyzer and failed field sobriety tests. The incident earned him a new nickname in the hallways of Walgreens headquarters, Michelob. Wade's DUIs and Dr. J's blind cheerleading for Theranos didn't inspire confidence that Project Beta was in the best hands. But that was beyond Hunter's purview. He focused on what he could control, continuing to ask tough questions on the weekly video calls until one day in early 2011, Lipinski told him that Elizabeth and Sonny no longer wanted him on the calls or in meetings between the companies. They felt that he was creating too much tension and that it interfered with getting work done, she said. Walgreens had no choice but to comply, or Theranos would walk away, she added. Hunter tried to convince her to rebuff the demand. Why was Walgreens paying his firm $25,000 a month to look out for its best interests if it was going to keep him at arm's length and make it harder for him to do his job? It made no sense. His protestations were politely ignored, and Elizabeth and Sonny got their way. Hunter continued to work with the innovation team and to provide his expertise when asked, but his exclusion from subsequent calls and meetings marginalized him and limited his input. In the meantime, Walgreens pushed ahead with the project. As part of the pilot preparations, Hunter joined the innovation team on a field trip to an unmarked warehouse in an industrial park a few miles from the Deerfield campus. Inside, the company had built a full-scale replica of one of its stores. It featured a blood-testing laboratory, with shelves designed specifically to accommodate the dimensions of the black-and-white Theranos readers. Seeing the mock store and its little lab brought home to Hunter how real it all was. Soon, actual patients were going to get their blood drawn and tested in one of these, he thought uneasily. Chapter 8. The Mini Lab. With Walgreens and Safeway on board as retail partners, Elizabeth suddenly faced a problem of her own making. She had told both companies her technology could perform hundreds of tests on small blood samples. The truth was that the Edison system could only do immunoassays, a type of test that uses antibodies to measure substances in the blood. Immunoassays included some commonly ordered lab tests, such as tests to measure vitamin D or to detect prostate cancer. But many other routine blood tests, ranging from cholesterol to blood sugar, required completely different laboratory techniques. Elizabeth needed a new device, one that could perform more than just one class of test. In November 2010, she hired a young engineer named Kent Frankovich and put him in charge of designing it. Kent had just obtained a master's degree in mechanical engineering from Stanford. Before that, he'd spent 2 years working for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, where he'd helped build Curiosity, the Mars rover. Kent, in turn, recruited Greg Baney, a friend he'd met at NASA who'd gone on to work for SpaceX, Elon Musk's Los Angeles-based rocket company. At 6 feet five and 260 pounds, Greg was built like an NFL lineman, but his physique belied a sharp intellect and a keen sense of observation. For a period of several months, Kent and Greg became Elizabeth's favorite employees. She sat in on their brainstorming sessions and made suggestions about what robotic systems they should consider using. She gave them company credit cards and let them charge whatever equipment and supplies they wanted. Elizabeth christened the machine she assigned them to build the Mini Lab. As its name suggested, her overarching concern was its size. She still nurtured the vision of someday putting it in people's homes and wanted something that could fit on a desk or a shelf. This posed engineering challenges because, in order to run all the tests she wanted, the Mini Lab would need to have many more components than the Edison. In addition to the Edison's photomultiplier tube, the new device would need to cram three other laboratory instruments in one small space: a spectrophotometer, a cytometer, and an isothermal amplifier. None of these were new inventions. The first commercial spectrophotometer was developed in 1941 by the American chemist Arnold Beckman, founder of the lab equipment maker Beckman Coulter. It works by beaming rays of colored light through a blood sample and measuring how much of the light the sample absorbs. The concentration of a molecule in the blood is then inferred from the level of light absorption. Spectrophotometers are used to measure substances like cholesterol, glucose, and hemoglobin. Cytometry, a way of counting blood cells, was invented in the 19th century. It's used to diagnose anemia and blood cancers, among other disorders. Laboratories all over the world had been using these instruments for decades. In other words, Theranos wasn't pioneering any new ways to test blood. Rather, the Mini Lab's value would lie in the miniaturization of existing lab technology. While that might not amount to groundbreaking science, it made sense in the context of Elizabeth's vision of taking blood testing out of central laboratories and bringing it to drugstores, supermarkets, and eventually, people's homes. To be sure, there were already portable blood analyzers on the market. One of them, a device that looked like a small ATM called the Piccolo Express, could perform 31 different blood tests and produce results in as little as 12 minutes. It required only 3 or 4 drops of blood for a panel of a half dozen commonly ordered tests. However, neither the Piccolo nor other existing portable analyzers could do the entire range of laboratory tests. In Elizabeth's mind, that was going to be the Mini Lab's selling point. Greg spent a lot of time studying commercial instruments made by diagnostics equipment makers to reverse engineer them and make them smaller. He ordered a spectrophotometer from a company called Ocean Optics and broke it apart to understand how it worked. It turned into an interesting project, but it made him question their approach. Instead of building new instruments from scratch to fit the arbitrary dimensions Elizabeth had laid out, Greg felt they would do better to take the off-the-shelf components they were laboring to miniaturize and integrate them together to test how the overall system worked. Once they had a working prototype, they could then worry about shrinking it. Emphasizing the system's size first and how it worked later was putting the cart before the horse. But Elizabeth wouldn't budge. Greg was in the midst of a breakup with the girl he'd dated in L.A., so he came to the office on Saturdays to get his mind off it. He could see that Elizabeth really appreciated that. She saw it as a sign of loyalty and dedication. She told Greg she wanted to see Kent come in on weekends, too. It bothered her that his friend didn't. Keeping a work-life balance seemed a foreign concept to her. She was at work all the time. Like most people, Greg had been taken aback by Elizabeth's deep voice when he'd first met her. He soon began to suspect it was affected. One evening, as they wrapped up a meeting in her office shortly after he joined the company, she lapsed into a more natural-sounding young woman's voice. I'm really glad you're here, she told him as she got up from her chair, her pitch several octaves higher than usual. In her excitement, she seemed to have momentarily forgotten to turn on the baritone. When Greg thought about it, there was a certain logic to her act. Silicon Valley was overwhelmingly a man's world. The VCs were all male, and he couldn't think of any prominent female startup founder. At some point, she must have decided the deep voice was necessary to get people's attention and be taken seriously. A few weeks after the voice incident, Greg picked up another clue that Theranos wasn't your usual workplace. He had become friendly with Gary Frenzel. Although Gary looked like a slob, he weighed 300 pounds and walked around the office in baggy jeans, an oversized t-shirt, and Crocs, Greg found him to be one of the smartest people at the company. Gary had a bad case of sleep apnea, and more than once during meetings, Greg had watched him doze off only to suddenly snap awake to refute a dumb idea someone had put forward and suggest a brilliant alternative. As they walked out of the office together one day, Gary lowered his voice and, in a conspiratorial tone, told Greg something that startled the younger man. Elizabeth and Sonny were in a romantic relationship. Greg felt blindsided. He thought it was inappropriate for the CEO of a company and its number two executive to be sleeping together. But what bothered him more was the fact they were hiding it. This was a crucial piece of information that he felt should have been disclosed to new recruits. For Greg, the revelation cast everything about Theranos in a new light. If Elizabeth wasn't being forthright about that, what else might she be lying about? Nepotism at Theranos took on a new dimension in the spring of 2011 when Elizabeth hired her younger brother, Christian, as Associate Director of Product Management. Christian Holmes was 2 years out of college and had no clear qualifications to work at a blood diagnostics company, but that mattered little to Elizabeth. What mattered far more was that her brother was someone she could trust. Christian was a handsome young man with eyes the same deep shade of blue as his sister's, but that was where the similarities between them began and ended. Christian had none of his sister's ambition and drive. He was a regular guy who liked to watch sports, chase girls, and party with friends. After graduating from Duke University in 2009, he'd worked as an analyst at a Washington, D.C. firm that advised corporations about best practices. When he first arrived at the company, Christian didn't have much to do, so he spent part of his days reading about sports. He hid it by cutting and pasting articles from the ESPN website into empty emails so that, from afar, it looked like he was absorbed in work-related correspondence. Christian soon recruited four of his fraternity brothers from Duke. Jeff Blickman, Nick Menchel, Dan Edlin, and Sani Hajimetovic. They were later joined by a fifth Duke friend, Max Fosk. They rented a house together near the Palo Alto Country Club and became known inside Theranos as the Frat Pack. Like Christian, none of the other Duke boys had any experience or training relevant to blood testing or medical devices, but their friendship with Elizabeth's brother vaulted them above most other employees in the company hierarchy. By then, Greg had convinced several of his own friends to join Theranos. Two of them were buddies from his undergraduate days at Georgia Tech, Jordan Carr and Ted Pasco. The third was a friend he'd made in Pasadena while working for NASA named Trey Howard. Trey happened to have gone to college at Duke a few years before the frat pack. Jordan, Trey, and Ted were all assigned to the product management group with Christian and his friends, but they weren't granted the same level of access to sensitive information. Many of the hush-hush meetings Elizabeth and Sonny held to strategize about the Walgreens and Safeway partnerships were off-limits to them, whereas Christian and his fraternity brothers were invited in. The frat pack endeared itself to Sonny and Elizabeth by working long days. Sonny was constantly questioning employees' commitment to the company. The number of hours a person put in at the office whether he or she was doing productive work or not, was his ultimate gauge of that commitment. At times, he would sit in the big glass conference room and stare out at the rows of cubicles, trying to identify who was slacking off. The numerous late nights they spent at the office left no time for exercise, so Christian and his friends snuck workouts in during the day. To elude Sonny's watchful gaze, they ducked out of the building at different times, using different exits. They were also careful never to return at the same time or together. Ted Pascoe, who had left a career on Wall Street to try his luck in Silicon Valley, but didn't have any clear duties during his first few months at Theranos, amused himself by timing their exits and entries. Several members of the frat pack joined Greg and two of his colleagues from the engineering department for lunch on the big terrace overlooking the parking lot one day. A discussion about the low IQs of some of the world's top soccer players led them to debate the question, would you rather be smart and poor or dumb and rich? The three engineers all chose smart and poor, while the frat pack voted unanimously for dumb and rich. Greg was struck by how clearly the line was drawn between the two groups. They were all in their mid to late 20s with good educations, but they valued different things. Christian and his friends were always ready and willing to do Elizabeth and Sonny's bidding. Their eagerness to please was on display when news broke that Steve Jobs had died on the evening of October 5, 2011. Elizabeth and Sonny wanted to pay Jobs a tribute by flying an Apple flag at half-mast on the grounds of the Hillview Avenue building. The next morning, Jeff Blickman, a tall redhead who'd played varsity baseball at Duke, volunteered for the mission. He couldn't locate any suitable Apple flag for sale, so Blickman had one custom made out of vinyl. It featured the famous Apple logo in white against a black background. The store he went to took a while to make it. Blickman didn't return with it until late in the day. In the meantime, work at the company came to a standstill as Elizabeth and Sonny moped around the office, consumed by the hunt for the Apple flag. Greg had been aware of Elizabeth's fascination with Jobs. She referred to him as Steve, as if they were close friends. At one point, she'd told him that a documentary espousing a 9/11 conspiracy theory wouldn't have been available on iTunes if Steve hadn't believed there was something to it. Greg thought that was silly. He was pretty sure Jobs hadn't personally screened all the movies for rent or sale on iTunes. Elizabeth seemed to have this exaggerated image of him as an all-seeing and all-knowing being. A month or two after Jobs's death, some of Greg's colleagues in the engineering department began to notice that Elizabeth was borrowing behaviors and management techniques described in Walter Isaacson's biography of the late Apple founder. They were all reading the book, too, and could pinpoint which chapter she was on based on which period of Jobs's career she was impersonating. Elizabeth even gave the mini-lab a Jobs-inspired code name, the 4S. It was a reference to the iPhone 4S, which Apple had coincidentally unveiled the day before Jobs passed away. Greg's honeymoon period at Theranos ended when his sister applied for a job at the company. After interviewing with both Elizabeth and Sonny in April 2011, she received an offer to join the product management team the following month, but decided to turn it down and stay with her employer, the accounting firm PwC. The next day, a Saturday, Greg was at the office working. Elizabeth was there too, but wouldn't acknowledge his presence, which he found odd, since she usually made a point to, especially on weekends. The following week, Greg stopped being invited to her brainstorming sessions with Kent. It dawned on him that she'd taken his sister's decision personally, and that he was now paying the price for it. Not long after, a chill descended on Kent's own relationship with Elizabeth. For all intents and purposes, Kent was the chief architect of the mini lab. A talented engineer who loved to build stuff, he was also dabbling with a side project in his spare time. bicycle lights that lit up both wheels and the road, providing improved visibility and safety for the rider at night. He'd pitched the concept on Kickstarter and, much to his surprise, was able to raise $215,000 in 45 days. It was the seventh largest sum raised on the crowdfunding platform that year. What had been a hobby suddenly looked like it could become a viable business. Kent told Elizabeth about his successful Kickstarter campaign, thinking she wouldn't mind. But he badly miscalculated. She and Sonny were furious. They viewed it as a major conflict of interest and asked him to transfer his bike lights patent to Theranos. The paperwork Kent had signed when he joined the company entitled them to any intellectual property he produced while employed there, they contended. Kent disagreed. He'd worked on his little venture during his free time and felt he had done nothing wrong. He also failed to see how a new type of bicycle light posed a threat to a maker of blood testing equipment. But Elizabeth and Sonny wouldn't let it go. In meeting after meeting, they tried to get him to turn over the patent. They ratcheted up the pressure by bringing Theranos' new senior counsel, David Doyle, to some of the meetings. As he watched the standoff unfold, Greg became convinced that it wasn't so much about the patent as it was about punishing Kent for his perceived disloyalty. Elizabeth expected her employees to give their all to Theranos, especially ones like Kent, whom she entrusted with big responsibilities. Not only had Kent not given his all, he'd devoted part of his time and energy to another engineering project. It explained why he hadn't been coming in on weekends like she wanted him to. As she saw it, Kent had betrayed her. In the end, a fragile compromise was reached. Kent would go on a leave of absence to give his bicycle light venture a shot. When he was done indulging his pet project, they'd have a conversation about whether and under what conditions he could return. Kent's departure put Elizabeth in a foul mood. She now looked to Greg and others to pick up the slack. Greg also sensed a growing urgency in Elizabeth and Sonny's behavior. They seemed to be squeezing the engineering team to meet some sort of deadline without communicating to them what that deadline was. They must have promised someone something, he thought. As Elizabeth grew impatient with the pace of the mini-lab's development, Greg bore the brunt of her frustration. When the engineering team gathered for weekly status updates, she opened the meetings by staring at him silently without blinking, until he broke the ice with a polite, "Hello, Elizabeth, how are you today?" He began keeping detailed notes of what was discussed and agreed to at each meeting that he could refer back to the following week to keep emotions out of it. Several times, Elizabeth came downstairs to the engineer's workshop and hovered over Greg while he worked. He politely acknowledged her, then resumed working in silence. It was some sort of strange power play, and he was determined not to get rattled by it. One afternoon, Elizabeth called him into her office and told him she sensed cynicism emanating from him. After a long silence, in which he debated telling her she was right, Greg decided to keep his growing disenchantment to himself and told a fib. He was upset because Sonny had rejected several job applicants that he thought were well qualified and hoped the company would hire. Elizabeth must have believed him, because she relaxed noticeably. "You need to tell us about these things," she said. On a weekday evening in December 2011, Theranos chartered several buses to transport its employees, which now numbered more than 100, to the Thomas Fogarty Winery in Woodside. It was Elizabeth's favorite place to hold corporate events. The winery's main building and its adjacent events facility were built on stilts into the hillside and offered panoramic views of the estate's rolling vineyards and of the valley beyond. The occasion was the company's annual Christmas party. As employees sipped drinks from an open bar inside the winery's main building before sitting down to dinner, Elizabeth gave a speech. "The mini lab is the most important thing humanity has ever built. If you don't believe this is the case, you should leave now, she declared, scanning her audience with a dead serious look on her face. Everyone